You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. And you may find yourself in another part of the world. And you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. And you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here? Let in the days go by, let the water hold me down, let in the gaze go by, water flowing underground, let to the blue again, after the money's gone, once in a lifetime, water flowing underground. And you may ask yourself, how do I work this? You may ask yourself, where is that large automobile? And you may ask yourself, you may tell yourself, this is not my beautiful house. And you may tell yourself, this is not my beautiful wife. Letting the days go by, let the water hold me down. Letting the days go by, water flowing underground into the blue again. After the money's gone, once in a lifetime, water flowing underground. Same as it ever was. Same as it ever was, 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 same as it ever was. Let in the days go by, let the water hold me down. Let in the days go by, water flowing underground into the blue again. In the silent water under the rocks and stones, there is water underground. And you may ask yourself, what is that beautiful house? And you may ask yourself, where does that highway go? And you may ask yourself, am I right? Am I wrong? And you may tell yourself, my God, what have I done? Let in the days go by, let the water hold me down. Let the days go by, water flowing underground. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show. And we're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And I am proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Frank Cordero, Sherwood Ross, Phil Ferruggio, Mickey Z, and Ava Bird. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream radio show in Des Moines, in Minneapolis, in Fort Lauderdale, in Southern California, in Coral Gables, in Port Orange, in Astoria, Queens, New York City, and wherever you are. What if Bernie Sanders had the balls to join with Jill Stein right now and make this a summer nobody would ever forget instead of just one more, here we go again? What if? We're in Minneapolis on our way to the Black Hills for a wedding. Minneapolis is the international news focus today with the shooting of a black man at a traffic stop. Obama is dismayed, of course, and he has murder, more murder on his hands. What do you expect to happen when you get the people all fired up and tense with all these false flag hoax shootings? Obama and his people are liars and murderers. My recommendations on YouTube, it's entitled How Sandy Hook Killed TV. YouTube, How Sandy Hook Killed TV. Books, The Burglary, about the break-in of an FBI office, which gave us the information about COINTELPRO that we were never going to get otherwise. Another book, Exposing Lies of the Empire by Andrei Vilcek, an independent journalist telling us the truth about the revolutions by the poor that have been taking place all around the world and about the efforts of the U.S. to undermine those revolutions and keep the poor poor and the rich people in the U.S. rich. Another book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. More about how revolutions against poverty around the world are attacked by the rich and powerful in the United States by someone who used to work for those rich people. Another book, The Plot to Kill King by William Pepper, about the conspiracy by the U.S. government, the Memphis police, the FBI, and the mob to murder Martin King with help from members of King's own inner group. And now, please join us for another episode of Beltway Sandy Snore, Big Time Journalism Horror. When we last left Sandy, he had just received, as he sat with a friend at the Bulldog Bistro in downtown D.C., a subpoena to appear at the next session of the House Un-American Activities Commission. He read the formal paper silently while his prime rib cooled to the taste of prime tuna. The committee will be reconvening next week to investigate un-American activities such as the murder of children in Iraq and Afghanistan and the restricting of personal freedoms in the United States through the so-called Patriot Act, as well as the infiltration of American organizations by members of certain domestic clandestine terror groups. Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Central Intelligence Agency? The next day, Sandy began to stoically prepare for the end. In the so-called green room, Sandy sat on a plush chair with the others, the chairs pushed back against the wall in almost a perfect circle, one chair absent, like a missing tooth, Sandy noted. Sandy knew many of those in the other chairs, sitting with their hands on their knees and their heads down. Some were famous, some not so much. One by one, the other journalists left the room when called. They were told to bring with them whatever they had brought, and they did not return, Sandy noted. At the end, it was just Sandy Van Snore and a woman from National Public Radio he had talked to one time at a party for the senator from Carolina. What's his name? He smiled at her, and she nodded back. The woman from NPR, who he could not quite get her name into his memory, was called. Sandy ran through the alphabet in his head, trying to get at least her first name, then remembered, what the heck, she's gone. They are all gone. He looked around the room and heard his name. Mr. Van Snore, Mr. Van Snore. He looked at the young woman in the door, rose, and followed her into the bright light as the condemned behind the sad, hooded priest. The big, bright room was busy, bustling, with young men and women holding papers, hurrying back and forth like worker ants with bits of leaf and sticks in their mouths. Someone touched Sandy by the tip of his elbow, and by that slight pressure was able to direct him wherever he needed to go, around tables, feet, canes, to a seat in the front row, facing the HUAC. Sandy sat and folded his hands atop the table. He could only hope he appeared sane, calm, innocent. He found his bearings. Without turning his head, he sighted up and down and around at the journalists kneeling and seated, aiming cameras at him, at the microphones up and down his long table, at the committee members across from him, talking over their shoulders, accepting pieces of paper from young people at the empty chair right in front of him. Someone, somewhere, pounded a gavel, and the room began to quiet, and the noise gradually subsided, like the waves in the big wave pool at 5 o'clock. A man to the side of the chair pulled the microphone toward himself. He looked right at Sandy as if Sandy were the only one in the room, the most important, and Sandy wondered if he might be a psychiatrist. He would make a good one. The man told Sandy that the chairwoman of the committee had wished very much to be here today, but on her way here this morning from her home state, her small plane crashed in a forest. There were no survivors, the man said. Sandy gasped and his mouth dropped open. He looked around the room and saw that everyone was busy doing something else, just keeping very quiet about it. He was the last to know. He looked back at the man who appeared to have taken over as head of the committee. Sandy drew a deep breath as he prepared for the coming grilling, the questions, the admonitions from the remaining committee members up and down the line. One woman in a green suit, three to the left of the empty chair, dragged her microphone over the wood, sending a squeak across the room and over the international airways. "Mr. Van Snore," she pronounced deliberately, "you are..." And her words echoed and squeaked, and Sandy stared at her and saw himself shuffling up the prison steps, wearing an orange jumpsuit, his hands cuffed at his waist. A flock of pigeons stirred for a moment and then sat back down as Sandy and his escorts passed on their way to the cold steel penitentiary front door. "You are the most entertaining media guest on the late-night talk shows. I have to say, we just love it, my family and I, and what I have to ask is, do you pick out your own suits yourself?" Sandy answered the question as best he could, and then another from another committee member about being an Ivy League football star. And did he ever wish he had gone to the NFL rather than into journalism? A short congressman from a southwest state down the line then asked Sandy if he tried to match his ties to any particular season or event, and then they were out of time. on his way out, a congressman from Idaho asked Sandy how he got those front row seats at the Nationals games. "I seen you on TV," the congressman said as he was whisked away by a young staff member to another meeting. Sandy stood alone in front of the big stone building. He turned to face the street. He waved the cab on and walked toward a place he knew. He sat at the bar looking up at the TV. He sat and stared and sipped. He watched the news, wondering about the committee chairwoman, about what had happened to the others in the green room. He watched until the news turned into the lead-in music for Survivor Borneo, then swiveled around, put his elbows on the bar, and looked around to search for anyone he knew. Join us next week for another episode of Sandy Van Snore, Journalism Whore, when we find Sandy working his regular job, doing what he's always done for over 20 years, as if nothing matters. Nothing. Our first guest of the evening is Ava Byrd. Ava Byrd is a poet and activist, and she lives in Southern California. She was one of our first guests on the show way back in 2011, and we are very happy that Ava is a regular guest now. Each month we get to hear from Ava, and Chuck is going to get Ava on the phone right about now.
Hi, Chuck and Mike.
Hello, Ava.
Hi. Are you there? I'm here.
Yeah, we're here. Go ahead, Ava.
Okay, good. Okay, good. Well, I just want to wish everybody a very happy summer. It's middle of July, and it's pretty hot everywhere, almost everywhere in the U.S. And in honor of so-called Independence Day, I would like to share an article called How the Land of the Free Became the Home of the Slaves. And this comes from Waking Times, wakingtimes.com. How the Land of the Free Became the Home of the Slaves. Prisoner number. It's time to go home. The most beautiful words she had ever heard as she dreamt about the day that phrase would be uttered for the past 10 years. Today, she will get to see her daughter that has been out of her life and begin the process of reunification. As she takes her first steps outside the prison walls in a decade, it is like stepping into a foreign land. Outside the concrete confinement, she is overwhelmed by the simplicity of feeling the fresh breeze, the sunlight, the green grass, and of course, her family. Her daughter, mother, and brother await her release in what feels like another world away. Her lower lip starts to tremble uncontrollably, which it always has done when she becomes emotional, only to see her 13-year-old daughter's lower lip mirror that of her own. Mother and daughter are able to embrace for the first time in years as they share an electric bond that cannot be broken, despite so many unanswered questions over the years. Why is my mom in jail? Why didn't I have a mom while growing up? Why wasn't anyone there to do my hair, makeup, or other little girl activities that everyone else enjoyed? Where was my mom all this time? These are the questions the little girl repeatedly asked throughout her lifetime without an answer that ever seemed to make sense. She once even wrote a letter to the judge prior to her mother's sentencing. It was written in 6-year-old writing in a blue crayon. It said, "Please help my mommy. I don't want her to go to jail for a long time. I want her to get better." This woman was a prisoner of war, another unnecessary and ineffective war that has destroyed far more lives than it has helped. A war that has built the highest population of incarcerated people per capita in the history of civilization, and yet the enemy, drug use, is at an all-time high. The war on drugs is the longest active war in American history and continues to run with no end in sight because it benefits the rich at the expense of the poor. Society's most loving, caring, and abused people are literally being reduced to a number, while corporations, politicians, and congressmen that write the laws of the land are profiting off the lives they are tearing apart. The Great Marketing Scheme. On June 17, 1971, President Richard Nixon officially declared the war on drugs. Quote, America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new, all-out offensive. End quote. A war is defined as a conflict between different nations or states, or different groups within a nation or state. But to declare a war on an inanimate object or concept means that there is no clear enemy, hence no end. And this is intentional. In fact, it is one of the greatest marketing schemes never told. It is drawn out as follows. 1.1. The president tells you the greatest risk to our safety is a concept, object, or philosophy, like communism, drugs, terror, etc. 1A. Declares a war that is not really a war. Cold war, drug war, war on terror. 2B. The American people are asked to pay the bill because money is not an issue. This is for our safety and security. 3C. They create a special agency that makes their own laws in their war. The CIA, the DEA, the NSA, Homeland Security, etc. 4.2. Laws are changed that support fighting this war, leading to a mass incarceration of anyone not in compliance. 5.3. The prisons become overcrowded, and therefore private prisons run by corporations need to be built to house prisoners. 6.A. Corporations are for profit, which means more prisoners equals more money. 7.B. They sign contracts with the government guaranteeing high occupancy rates, usually between 90 to 100% for up to 20 years. This gives incentives to lock up more people because they have to pay regardless as to whether or not the bed is filled. The quality of care and supervision is poor because it is a business and they seek cheap labor and cost-cutting techniques like every other business. Corporations then rent prisoners for free labor, also known as slavery. The private prisons then lobby to Congress to make stricter laws to lock up more people. Congress obliges because it helps them win elections, and Congress makes the laws of the country, and they don't bite the hand that feeds. Then, since they know the laws, they buy stock in these same private prisons. 15C, profit off their investments. Then the war against concept shifts overseas. This allows to overthrow poor countries under the disguise as a war against our greatest threat. Allowing to steal natural resources. 2, install a puppet government that benefits our corporate interests. 18, politicians that declare war also have stock in arms manufacturers like General Electric, Raytheon, etc. More wars mean more arms need to be built. They profit off their investments again. In order to overthrow governments without making it obvious to the public, they hire a guerrilla insurgents to do so. They train these rebel groups and supply arms. In turn, these groups pay for the arms by supplying illegal drugs. The CIA returns these illegal drugs into the inner cities of America. Then they arrest people and put them in private prisons in which they profit by selling the same drugs they brought into the country, in which they profit, to arm rebel groups to overthrow governments and install puppet governments which support U.S. corporations and gain further profit, in which the lawmakers also have stock interests. It is such a brilliant concept that we have recently followed suit by launching a war on terror, another war without a clear enemy, against a concept that will never have a definitive outcome, which only profits those with heavy stock interests. Like John Kerry, Secretary of State, has made $26 million off his investments directly related to the war on terror. Isn't that a conflict of interest? This is not freedom. This is fascism. We proudly claim to be the land of the free, yet we have more people locked up than any other civilization in the history of the world, with the majority of them in there for nonviolent drug offenses. The United States is home to only 5% of the world's population, but holds 25% of the world's prison population. We currently have more black men and women behind bars per capita than that of all apartheid in South Africa, all part of money-making scheme for corporations. The war on drugs race. All the drug laws in America have their racist and discriminatory foundations. The first drug law came in 1875 in San Francisco, which was a banning of opium dens as a discrimination against Chinese-American immigrants. National headlines linked cocaine to causing violent behavior in African-Americans, and laws were soon put in place. Marijuana was used recreationally in the southwestern United States by Mexican immigrants in the 1920s, and laws were established that were geared at incriminating Mexicans. But these were just the early battles before the war was officially declared. In June of 1971, Nixon declared the war on drugs, making most street drugs illegal with stricter penalties. 2 years later, the DEA was created to enforce drug laws and bring those criminals to justice. More arrests meant more people in jails and prisons. The prisons started to overflow, and the need for more prisons arose. Corporations got involved and built private, for-profit prisons. They arranged contracts with the government to remain at high occupancies, further incentives for the government to arrest nonviolent drug offenders and keep them for longer sentences. In the notorious Kids for Cash scandal, two judges in Pennsylvania were convicted of taking cash payments from prisons as bribery to sentence more juveniles to fill their beds. They were locking up kids for minor offenses and changing lives forever for sums of money. And these are just the ones that are getting caught. The prisons spend millions of dollars each year lobbying with Congress to change and keep laws that allow locking up more people for nonviolent drug offenses. In turn, members of Congress, the people who write the laws, have investments in private prisons, encouraging them to keep these laws that help their portfolios. Prison labor. An increased prison population helps out more than just the prison industry. Many other corporations have invested in prison labor. At least 37 states have legalized contracting of prison labor, including corporations such as IBM, Motorola, Microsoft, AT&T, Dell, Honeywell, Target, and many more mount their operations inside of prisons. This is also known as slavery. In fact, this idea of convict leasing arose after the Civil War. The South was built by stealing Native American land and utilizing free slave labor to build America into one of the wealthiest nations on earth. But after slavery was abolished and African Americans were emancipated, the corporations needed cheap labor. Freed slaves started getting charged with petty crimes and sentenced to many years in prison. Once in prison, they were leased to work picking cotton and building railroads. Just slavery with a different name. After the drug war launched in 1971, the prison population has skyrocketed by locking up African Americans at an alarming rate to work for free for corporations. We really have not changed. We just find new and creative ways to hide the atrocious human rights crimes. Just say no. In 1986, Nancy Reagan told us to just say no to drugs. While she was telling us not to do drugs, her husband and President Ronald Reagan was making illegal deals to fund illegal wars, which brought those same drugs into our inner cities. The Iran-Contra scandal involved Reagan illegally selling arms to Iran, despite an embargo on arms to Iran, in exchange for payments. This money went to fund the Nicaraguan Contra rebel fighters to embark in a guerrilla war against the Sandinista government of Nicaragua. The Sandinista government was democratically elected, which overtook a 40-year-old Somoza dictatorship. The Sandinista government implemented welfare, health, education, and housing reform. Peasants were... Also, it's the rest next time. It was great to be with you guys again.
Good night, Ava.
Blessing.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Red, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
Enjoy your
extra big-ass fries.
You didn't give me no fries. I got an empty box.
Would you like another
extra big-ass fries?
I said I didn't get any.
Thank you. Your account has been charged. Your balance is zero. Please
what?
Come back when you can afford
oh,
to make
no,
a purchase.
No.
I'm sorry you're having
come on.
Trouble.
My kids are starving.
Thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio. Here at Revolution Radio, we believe in freedom of ideas, freedom of speech, but above all, we believe in freedom of existence through self-reliance. This station is 100% listener-supported, and as a fundraising promotion, I have a kick-ass free gift for a $100 donation. 35,000 seeds. 25 years in the freezer, long-term storable, 54 different varieties. So if food prices go crazy, the shit hits the fan, or if you just want to save tons of money every year by creating your own food like I do, grab our seed pack special. Just look for the banner on the homepage at freedomslips.com. Don't be a statistic. Don't be part of the problem. Be part of the solution. We need, as humans, to start taking care of ourselves and not depending on the megacorps to provide unhealthy, nasty food. Included in this package is also a DVD with 900 survival and off-grid living documents and the offline home canning how to do everything website all on the DVD. So when you're growing all that food, you know how to can it, store it, preserve it, etc. with all these documents. So thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I hope that you will pick up this package and start learning to be free. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps and freedom is one seed that needs to be planted.
What we do in life, it goes in eternity.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Those of you who are working hard, even sweating through summer school, to earn advanced degrees from major universities on public policy and history, there's still a good portion of the summer left. Stop. Just stop. Get your money back. They're not going to tell you the truth anyway. Take an hour each morning to read the comment section of Memory Hole blog, maintained by James Tracy, who was fired from Florida Atlantic University for stating that nobody died at Sandy Hook, that it's all a government psyop. And then after that hour, each bright summer morning, you have the rest of the day free. Enjoy! Here's a sample of the advanced learning in store for you for free. The Hillary emails. No prosecution, says the FBI. California voters, your votes don't count. The FBI orders all Orland records withheld from the public. Just what did you expect? If the crime of 9/11 wasn't investigated, perps not prosecuted, missing 3.2.3 trillion, Rummy said was missing, not looked into, if the new admin coming in wouldn't prosecute the corrupt admin going out, the new admin could allegedly capture the most wanted man in the world and dump him in the drink with no evidence, then SEAL Team 6 could be smudged. Then on top of these crooked bricks, more to follow, setting world policy built with more crooked bricks. Well, why? Why be surprised? It's just a matter of time till it all comes crashing down. And now for yet another episode of Escape from the Okefenokee Swamp. We have met ISIS and they are us, U.S. Look out for commies, look out for reds, look out, they're under your bed. Look out for criminals, look out for liberals, look out for Ahab the Arab. Look out for Al-Qaeda, look out for Bob Qaeda and the Taliban too. We have met ISIS and they are us. U.S. That is us. U.S. U.S.A.
Our next guest of the evening is Frank Cordero. Frank Cordero is a member of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. He's a former Catholic priest. He has spent over 6 years in federal prison for various actions in protest of the U.S. military machine. And now Frank Cordero.
Well, you know, right now to let the folks know, I'm not at the worker house. I'm on vacation with siblings, something that my family does. We've been doing it for close to 20 years. It's just a great time for now our old farts to get together and just to talk about things that families talk about. And I'm, I have wonderful brothers and a sister. They're great people. And I'm just struck as I talk to them that we really do live in different worlds. I at the Catholic Worker and they, in the lives they lead. One's a Catholic principal at a Catholic grade school. The other works for a Catholic church in Illinois. I got another brother who has worked for the church and now works for churches and trying to raise funds for them. I have a very churchy service family, and I think that's just great. I'm very proud of them, all of them. I'm just struck, though. They're Democrats, although one brother is another brother has become a Republican, so he's a little off a field for the family. But we're nothing exceptional or anything. However, I'm just amazed that my own, after 40 years at the Catholic Worker, and really, living begging, basically on the beg, relying on people to help us do the works of mercy. It's really been a great life. It's a privileged life. On the other hand, my brothers and my sisters and their kids, you know, they're living the regular life. They're doing good work. They're doing good people. But, boy, they're caught up in the culture and the money traps. And they just can't imagine, hard to imagine living a different way. And it's hard for me to imagine them also living a different way because we're all living in this culture. We're all wanting fast answers. The Catholic worker is just not a fast answer to the ills and the wrongs that we live in. It's a point of reference. And those of us it's an antidote, the fever of madness of the culture. So we at least have a perspective that's from the bottom up. And that really was distinctively different because I love my brothers and sisters and cousins and great people, but they're really not poor, certainly not by the standards of the human race, which are now the standards we must measure ourselves since we are all together in relationships. As close as the underwear I'm wearing, somebody made them. I don't know who they are, and I don't know how they've been treated, but they could be people on another side of the planet. And my faith says if I'm in relationship with someone, then I ought to be in good relationships, proper relationships, and we're not. And it's very hard. So the Catholic worker is something that means basically our antidote is bridge the gap between us and them, where there are people who are less fortunate. It's incumbent. It's our responsibility to bridge the gap and try to have a common experience. For us, it's the works of mercy, what we do on a daily basis. And also for us, it's the active peace stuff that we do, especially when we go abroad, trying to represent Americans who are awful people in the world that we go and visit, whose systems and powers and principalities dictate life and death for much of the globe. And it isn't a good thing. So it's very hard to address it for answers. And I'm just because I'm living in the same culture and I've got these great relatives and family. I'm not a sparing word about them. It's just, as Peter Morin used to say, you know, we got to make it where it's easier, a society where it's easier to do good. I like that because I know because of what I've chosen to do, live on the beg from month to month at a Catholic worker, and we're living well, and we're feeding people, we're doing well. For me to serve the poor, all I have to do is roll out of bed, and it's doing it. That's how it's easy for a guy like me. Now, if I had the same job my brothers have, you know, and the same obligations and families, for them to come and serve a bowl of soup, it's all like move heaven and earth to get it scheduled. It's not that they can't do good where they're at, but these days, for clarity, all of us have to bridge the gap between those of us of privilege and those who suffer because of our privilege. It's just, it's a proactive thing. Everybody's got to do it. I'm just grateful as a Catholic worker. I'm just in the midst of it all the time. Maybe not doing it all that well, but as Peter Morin coined it, it's a place where it's easy for me to do good, and this I'm grateful for. Maybe that's what I'd say. Rambling a bit.
Well, Frank, thank you. No, I like that very much. It was from the heart, and I really appreciate your sharing it with us.
I think if I have anything to offer the conversation is I'm a personalist. So as big as my plans are, I don't see it any further than one relationship to the next. That's really where it's got to be done. And then proper relationships, and that's what I meant by the underwear from Taiwan. We got to get together with the people who are supporting us. We got to have a relationship with people who feed us.
That's right.
We got to do that.
You know,
all right.
Everything starts with us, with ourselves, with each other. And
we're
living it.
Just one more thing. I'm looking at my brothers, and I said, all I know is that we're part of a generation, the baby boomers, who have lived our whole life.
Yeah.
Now let's try to figure out what that means. So that's worth another conversation.
Maybe next
all right,
time.
Chuck.
Thank
all right.
you, Frank.
All right, brother.
And
all right, brother.
Have a great time with your relatives.
Thank you.
It sounds
okay.
wonderful.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our next guest of the evening is Sherwood Ross. Sherwood Ross has worked as a reporter for the Chicago Daily News and a workplace columnist for Reuters. He's also been a media consultant. He was news director for the National Urban League and talk show host at WOL Radio Washington, D.C. He read at the National Press Club Yamamoto's Decision in one of his poems. His favorite quotations are from the Sermon on the Mount. And Chuck is going to get Sherwood on the line right about now.
Sherwood.
Well, hello, Sherwood. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Thanks, Chuck and Mike. It's always a pleasure. Now, I was thinking the other day, this is a topsy-turvy world. Yesterday's most feared nations, the ones ruled by Hitler in Germany, you know, Japan under Tojo, Juan Perón in Argentina, Stalin in Russia. They were all dictatorships, and today they are more or less democracies. And America, just the opposite of democracy under Franklin Roosevelt, today is making war in so many countries, the average American can't name them all. You know, that's not what a democracy does. For decades, citizens in totalitarian nations like Germany, they were afraid to speak their minds. And it seems to me that same kind of fear is coming to America. It's hard for Americans to understand this because we've never lost freedom of speech. But to give you an example, in Stalin's Russia, the greatest composer on the planet, Dmitri Shostakovich, he used to sleep on some blankets in the hallway outside his apartment's front door. Why? Because the secret police, when they came for him, he didn't want them breaking down his door and frightening his family when they took him away. What was the composer's offense? There wasn't any. There didn't have to be any. It's just that Shostakovich was more popular than Stalin. Stalin couldn't stand it. Even though the secret police never came for him, the composer lived as if they were about to. That's because other poets and film producers and artists that he knew were arrested, taken off to the camps, never seen again, murdered. Yevgeny Yevtushenko, the great Russian poet, also lived in fear of the government. The Russian dictators didn't arrest him, but they threw both his grandfathers in detention camps. I mean, can you imagine what a menace the two old grandfathers must have been to Joe Stalin? Yevtushenko still refused to give in to them, and he wrote Babi Yar, a poem about the Nazi extermination of Jews in Russia's Ukraine during World War II. I'll quote just a few lines. No monument stands over Babi Yar, a steep cliff only, like the rudest headstone. I am afraid. Today I am as old as the entire Jewish race itself. I see myself an ancient Israelite. I wander o'er the roads of ancient Egypt, and here upon the cross I perish, tortured, and even now I bear the marks of nails. And I myself, like one long, soundless scream, above the thousands and thousands interred, I'm every old man executed here, and I'm every child murdered here. Yevtushenko was lucky to get away with these words that Stalin was anti-Semitic. Well, the Russians, by their own hand, have junked communism. I think the reason is because no people can stand to live in a society for very long where justice is arbitrary, where the laws don't mean anything, where the rules change. The totalitarian society satisfies people for a short time, if it satisfies at all. A nation has got to breathe the air of freedom or perish. In Argentina, when the military overthrew the civilian government in 1976, the generals arrested poet Juan Gelman's son and stepdaughter and murdered them both. So here's my own poem on the subject of Yevtushenko. Yevgeny Yevtushenko, I read your night of poetry and I am awed. I sleep with pens and a yellow legal pad beside my bed, yet nothing so wonderful day or night pops into my head as the poetry you and your friends read around the campfire on the banks of the pure blue river running deep in the woods of Siberia. In the dark night under stars hanging down big as lanterns over Bratsk, where you have built the great power plant. For the first time in my life, I long to be a Russian. It's more than the way you describe your beautiful country. It's your love of life that I admire, the intensity of your feeling, your poetry, your music, your animated conversation. Each person reading his or her own verse, while the thick soup cooks in the kettle over the open fire, while vodka disappears down burning throats, while the show-off stands kicking up their boots, while women offer their delicious mouths in the woods in Cerenka, your accordion player squeezes out a tango from the distant Argentine. Ah, the Argentine, can it be as beautiful as your Bratsk? In a few hours, the Argentine will be under its own starry sky. Yes, under the same fat yellow moon climbing up the horizon, like a giant wall clock, honoring the hours of the night. Is someone there in Cordoba on the Pampas picking up a Spanish guitar and softly, sweetly playing Moscow Nights in answer to your tango on the other side of the world in the Argentine? Do I hear Juan Gelman reading his poetry, reading from unthinkable tenderness? Yes, and it's the same Juan Gelman whose family fled Russia during the revolution to find sanctuary in Argentina, only years later to have Argentine generals in their dirty war against people arrest Gelman's young son and his daughter-in-law and murder them both. Just as Stalin arbitrarily sent both of you Yevtushenko's grandfathers to the gulag. Explain it to me. Tell me. I do not understand. Is there no government that will let its people live in peace? Listen, friends, pick up your ears. Listen to the wind rising. For the wind carries the voices of the poets forever around the curves of the earth in oratorical orbit. Hear the two poetic voices calling out across the oceans, from Russia, from Argentina, as with one voice, love one another, only love one another. One conclusion I draw on this poem is that the rulers in Argentina and Russia did hear the wind rising. They did hear the poets singing. They did get rid of fascist dictatorship. And they are more free today than some other countries I could mention. what history does show us is that nations can be democratic 1 year or one decade or two decades and lapse into totalitarianism the next year or for the next couple of decades. It's that simple. America was defending the free world in 1943, but the CIA was overthrowing Chile in 1973. And it's overthrown, what, 20, 30 countries since then as well? So let's erase the boundary lines that separate nations. Those people in Iran and Ukraine and Afghanistan and Vietnam, they're our brothers and sisters. Let's make a greater effort to love them and put an end to the Pentagon's efforts to kill them. It's our choice. We can listen to the dictators who preach hate or to the poets who preach love. And I'm Sherwood Ross. My address, SherwoodRoss@gmail.com. If you like this show, let us know. If you like this show, let us know. SherwoodRoss@gmail.com. Let me hear from you. Good night to every one of you.
That was very moving, Sherwood, and we thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, just like William Shirer. Have a good night.
You too, Sherwood. Talk to you next month.
Fries, I got an empty box.
Would you like another?
Extra big ass fries.
I said I didn't get any.
Thank you. Your account has been charged. Your balance is zero. Please
what?
Come back when you can afford to make
a
purchase.
No, no.
I'm sorry you
had
trouble.
Come on.
I'm
My kids
sorry
are starving.
Thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio. Here at Revolution Radio, we believe in freedom of ideas, freedom of speech, but above all, we believe in freedom of existence through self-reliance. This station is 100% listener-supported, and as a fundraising promotion, I have a kick-ass free gift for a $100 donation. 35,000 seeds. 25 years in the freezer, long-term storable, 54 different varieties. So if food prices go crazy, the shit hits the fan, or if you just want to save tons of money every year by creating your own food like I do, grab our seed pack special. Just look for the banner on the homepage at freedomslips.com. Don't be a statistic. Don't be part of the problem. Be part of the solution. We need, as humans, to start taking care of ourselves and not depending on the megacorps to provide unhealthy, nasty food. Included in this package is also a DVD with 900 survival and off-grid living documents and the offline home canning how to do everything website all on the DVD. So when you're growing all that food, you know how to can it, store it, preserve it, etc. with all these documents. So thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I hope that you will pick up this package and start learning to be free. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps and freedom is one seed that needs to be planted.
When we do it live.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being.
When the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Right. You tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Did you ever feel that things were not quite right? That everything was just ever so slightly askew?
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, a splinter in your mind?
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements,
longevity,
fantastic discoveries in science,
download it to your brain,
then tune in to us. Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Mackie.
And we are Shiny Side Out, Sundays 2 to 4 a.m. Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Now,
from Port Orange, Florida, was stopped at World News Trust and Nation of Change and many other sites. Here's Phil Ferrugia with It's the Umpire, Stupid.
All right, here we go. A little treat for my working stiff friends, even though I took the summer off. Born on the 5th of July, I do love my country, not its leaders or institutions. One incident that will always remain in my database of memories occurred in 1984. I had sold my small business and was wallowing in self-pity at a broken love affair. So I treated myself to a one-week holiday in mid-August at a Club Med in Martinique. Most, if not all, vacationers to these places go in pairs or groups. Few, if any, go it alone, but I did. The Club Med was fine, the weather was too hot, and the food not to my New York liking. After 2 days of this and a terrible bug bite on my leg, I just said, screw this, and left the joint. When I got out of the car service at my apartment on Long Island, New York, I remember vividly what I did next. At the top of the stairs of my attic apartment, I opened the door and went to my knees, kissing the floor. I made the pledge to myself, out loud for effect, never to say anything bad about my country again. Well, as they said in the great David Mamet film, things change. William Shire was a German-based correspondent for the Chicago Tribune and author of the great book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. He was right there in Berlin at the beginning of Hitler's seizure of power and stayed on until forced out by the Gestapo after the war broke out. Shire made an astute observation of the reaction of the majority of Berliners when Germany invaded Poland in September of 1939. He remembered the massive, almost hysterical crowds in the streets when Hitler had become chancellor in January of 1933. Yet when the first group of Wehrmacht troops returned home after the brief and successful invasion of Poland, most Berliners seemed oblivious to it all. No mass celebrations like in 1933. Things change. When Bush 1 did his deed in the first war on Iraq, the propaganda machine worked overtime. Remember the countless yellow ribbons around the trees and the bumper stickers? The media had a field day with a righteous kill on those dangerous Iraqis. Of course, the media did not overplay the infamous meeting between U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie and Saddam Hussein, whereupon she more or less told him, quote, "We have no opinion on your Arab conflicts, such as your dispute with Kuwait. Secretary of State James Baker has directed me to emphasize the instruction first given to Iraq in the 1960s that the Kuwait issue is not associated with America." Saddam smiled. Basically, the American public, meaning the majority, felt good about what transpired after that. It could fall under that slippery sloped category of a just war. Of course, 10 years later, the spin machine again worked overtime with help from the lackeys like Judith Miller. They sold us a need to once again go after the boogeyman Saddam and his phony ties to bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. You see, they told us all the way to the United Nations with another lackey, Colin Powell, that Iraq had WMDs and would use them if necessary. Well, this time the country was divided perhaps 50-50 on that one. Never since the Vietnam disgrace was there ever such an outpouring of dissent against a possible war on Iraq. Worldwide, on that February day, hundreds of millions of people marched against such an endeavor. One guess is that 50-50 is not enough to stop this empire. My dear friend and peace activist Ed Dunphy made a sign up 7 years ago, and he held it at the campus of Princeton University each week. It read simply, "Bush equals Obama equals Bush." Now, Ed must have been psychic. In 2011, Obama signed off on the highest percentage of taxpayer money going down the rabbit hole of military spending, over 50%. He continued the illegal and immoral occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, and upon the urging of warmongering neocon in Democrats' clothing, Miss Hillary Clinton, he signed off on the NATO, U.S.-controlled, of course, attack and destruction of Libya. While this was going on, Obama once again allowed his advisors to influence him to sign off on giving weapons and support to rebels in Syria, which, of course, continues, which we know had ties to Al-Qaeda, and which is now ISIL. Meanwhile, the stooge in the White House continues to antagonize Russia by devious means, economic sanctions with NATO, WMDs poised on its borders, so as to create the next crisis to justify our obscene military spending and our empire's footprint worldwide. A new Cold War. Gandhi had said it best, the truth is still the truth, even if you are a minority of one. Thank you. Good night.
For decades, centuries, America and the world has been protected by those strong enough, smart enough to hear the voice of honor calling to their hearts, those brave warriors to whom we owe our freedom. Who can forget Dorothy Day, Emma Goldman, Eugene Debs, George McGovern, Peter Morin, Amon Hennessy, Lucy Parsons, Big Bill Haywood. And today we salute those who continue to answer the call. The few, the proud, the women from Code Pink. Food Not Bombs, a global force for good. Be all you can be. Join We Are Change or your local 9/11 truth group today. Aim high with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. An army of one or two or three at four in the morning, underwater, through the swamp, with a hammer in their teeth, over the fence, through the fence, into the building to hammer on United States military killing machines and destroy them. The Plowshares Movement, defending freedom and humanity since September 9th, 1980. We're looking for a few good women in black. Be part of the action. The world can't wait. Veterans for Peace, it's not just a job, it's an adventure. Peace is our profession. Join the Occupy movement. They're strong, and there's Catholic workers strong. Semper Fi. Oorah. Our next guest of the evening is Mickey Z. Mickey Zezima, was born and raised in Astoria, Queens, has appeared in a book with Noam Chomsky, and in a martial arts film with Billy Blanks. With only a high school diploma, he has authored 12 books and has spoken and lectured in venues ranging from MIT to ABC No Rio, from Yale University to Occupy Free University. Howard Zinn called him provocative and bold. And now Mickey Z in Astoria, Queens, New York City.
Well, it's the beginning of another month. This one is July, so we just had an Independence Day, so-called, celebrations, and well, we're welcoming to the show Mickey Z, our friend and columnist from Astoria, New York, and see what we have to talk about today. Welcome to the show, Mickey.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
All right. So, did you see lots of fireworks over the last few days?
Yeah, it's still kind of a big deal up here in New York. I mean, besides the big one that happens that Macy's puts on, there's individual shows elsewhere, and it gets pretty loud and absurd up here. How about you?
It was really loud and absurd in my neighborhood the last several nights. I mean, just crazy. I think somebody a block or two away must have, you know, dropped a grand or so on fireworks and
wow,
setting them off at all hours, and not just on the 4th, but for several days. I found it rather annoying.
Yeah, I concur. I mean, even afterwards, like trying to sleep and stuff like that, like it seems strange. I went to there's a park in my neighborhood called appropriately Astoria Park, and it's on the East River across from Manhattan, and they do a fireworks show there every year before, like this year it fell on June 30th, and so I hadn't gone in a while, and it's walking distance, so I went, and probably about 5 years since I went, and I did notice that it was a much bigger crowd than I expected, bigger than I remembered, but the police presence, the NYPD presence, was drastically greater, and they had barricades and police tape and checkpoints and so on, and I just noticed in the crowd itself, it seemed there were more, like there were people walking around selling stuff in the middle of the park, and there just seemed to be more of the super patriotic pro USA stuff than I ever remembered before. So it seems like that trend is kicking in this year. Not surprisingly, when you consider the presidential election dynamics.
Yeah, well, I agree. It does seem as though the uber patriotic movement is really gaining a lot of momentum, and it's not just us. I mean, things are pretty crazy all over the world these days.
Oh yeah, I mean, I just was reading about the new president of the Philippines, who has been euphemistically called the Trump of the East. Huh. And he's more like he doesn't even attempt to hide what he's about. He's just pretty horrendous. When he was the mayor of a city in the Philippines, a woman tourist was gang raped and murdered there. And when he spoke as mayor, he said it was a terrible thing to happen, but she was a beautiful woman. You would have thought they'd let the mayor go first. And this is a man who's now president. Yep. And so it's on YouTube. I mean, this is a rumor. He said, and when he was asked about it recently, he said, I was joking, but he didn't deny that he said it. And now that he's president, he's been calling for, like paramilitary street violence and extrajudicial executions of, if he said basically, if you see people you think are drug dealers or criminals, kill them. And the number of people killed in the Philippines has already skyrocketed. So, and this is a man that's been likened to Trump. And then, of course, when you consider what's happening in with Brexit and so on, I like to call it, I mean, I like is probably the wrong word. I prefer to call it, the general phenomenon Trumpism, because it doesn't necessarily match the semantical definition of fascism per se. But I believe that the phenomenon that's been sparked over the past 12 months since he entered the race and basically took over the world media has been an emboldening of white supremacists, of misogynists, of very, very dangerous people that perhaps previously would have been more nervous to voice these hateful opinions. And now they suddenly feel that they're on the rise. And I just witnessed it this morning, listening to people talk overhearing people talk right here in New York City, where there's been a shift in what's seemingly acceptable in public conversation.
In some ways, I think it's a backlash against the political correctness movement, which has really gone way too far in trying to make everything nice and trying to hide what was really going on, because that wasn't any good either, because people weren't being honest. But well, now they're being honest, but they're being hateful.
Yeah,
I don't know. We need something different.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the concept of political correctness seems to have a very amorphous meaning anyway. So we could do a whole show just discussing how it's used by individual groups and so on to promote their agenda. But in terms of it being a backlash, I couldn't agree more. I mean, when a white supremacist candidate runs on the platform of Make America Great Again after 8 years of a black president, I mean, he's wink, wink. What's great again? You know, we tried the black guy for 8 years. Let's get great again. And as you know, I am no fan of Obama, and I've been one of his most vocal critics. But my critique of him has nothing to do with his skin color. And while the Trumpsters just will call him a Muslim and a Kenyan, and I just saw an article yesterday about some parade in Indiana, an Independence Day parade in Indiana, in which somebody made a papier-mâché doll of Obama coming out of a toilet and labeling him the lying African. And I feel like this is what's been emboldened, that people are comfortable marching in a parade saying this. And so when they say Make America Great Again, I mean, it seems pretty transparent what they're getting at. And unfortunately, I don't really hear enough people, particularly on the left, taking Trumpism seriously, because from my perspective, it's already, Trumpism is already the winner of the 2016 election. The shift has already happened in this country. People are scared. People of color and women are more scared than ever. And it's not about whether or not he can win. And of course he can. He's in the election. Of course he can win. But this mindset is being taken very lightly. And it goes to show, I think, how the left has always been very dominated from a white male perspective. And white males aren't as much in danger by Trumpism early on. So I look around at traditional left websites and commentators, and I see them just dedicating day after day after day to writing the same laundry list of Hillary Clinton's transgressions, and it's a long list. But at some point, you say to yourself, I've been saying, do you want Obama's third term with Hillary, or do you want Mussolini's second term with Trump? And I to me, the choice is, it's horrible that we're put in this choice, but Trump is not the same as all the other candidates, and what he's spurring in this country and around the globe, as we said, is something that's an urgent and grave danger.
Well, it's definitely an urgent and grave danger. I certainly have my differences with Hillary, but Trump is really scary.
I'm sorry?
Trump is really scary.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We can be nuanced. We can recognize Hillary Clinton as the corporate-funded war criminal that she is, and also recognize that Trumpism is, in this, at least in the short term, the more urgent concern. We can't anyone. I mean, it sounds almost cliche to say it, but I mean, my first book in 2000 was called Saving Private Power, and the subtitle was The Hidden History of the Good War, in quotes. And so I've done, a fair amount of homework on what leading up to World War II. It's not anything that the average person doesn't know. And I saw a video yesterday of a man who was in a concentration camp in Serbia in 1991 and fortunately survived and then moved to England and became a citizen there. And then he said, he's looking around at what's happening on the streets, the hatred of foreigners there. And then he said, nobody expects it to happen to them. He said, did I expect one day to wind up in a concentration camp where a man who was once my favorite teacher in school became my torturer and interrogator? He said, of course, nobody expects it. They think it happens to other people. But the rhetoric I'm hearing coming out of the Trump campaign is worse than I was hearing in the Balkans in 1991. And wow. even if this man is engaging in a fair amount of hyperbole. I'm not sure he is, but let's say he is. What's the downside of taking Trumpism very seriously? Either he or Hillary Clinton is going to be president in November. It's not like we can snap our fingers and make Bernie win or Jill Stein win or any of these other people. The fact is that Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton is going to be the next president. So there is no good choice. But if Trumpism is pushing us to a situation where foreigners and people of color and women are being attacked on the streets and feel afraid, I think if we call ourselves justice-minded people, we need to take that very, very seriously.
Well, some months back, I predicted that Trump is going to be the next president, and I haven't changed my opinion on that. It's not something I want, but that's the way I feel it's going.
What leads you to make that prediction, Chuck?
Part of it is exactly what you're saying, is that people don't take him seriously enough.
Hillary acts as
if she's won already.
Yeah, I mean, her campaign seems ridiculously out of touch, whether it was dealing with Bernie Sanders or dealing with Donald Trump. I agree with you there. But what's frightening, the people taking Trump seriously are his supporters. They take him very seriously. And I see on the left, the broad coalition of what we call the left from Democrats to anarchists, or however you want to phrase it, the people who became very passionately behind Bernie Sanders, I would dare say irrationally behind, are built up so much vitriol for Hillary Clinton during the primary season that they seem unable to come to terms with the possibility of voting for her over Donald Trump because their guy lost. Many of them are talking about not voting. Some of them are saying they're going to vote Green Party and so on. And it doesn't take a political genius to say that every left-ish person who doesn't vote or votes for Jill, is helping Trump in that sense, because his people are going to come out. And they're not staying home in November. The people who are coming to his rallies and cheering and bringing their guns with them and threatening to bring their guns to Cleveland for the convention. I mean, the next time you and I talk, we may be talking about quite a dangerous situation that arose there. And they're coming out. So I wonder what's going on the left that they're so married to the idea, as I was, that there's no big difference between the two parties, and every 4 years we get twiddly-dee and twiddly-dumb. And then suddenly there's a chance now to put our rhetoric into action, because we talk about fighting for justice for decades, and then now this threat of some type of quasi-fascism is right at our doorstep, and everybody's saying, yeah, but Hillary's a crook, or but Hillary this, but Hillary that, or her husband did this. And I'm like, all right, well then, in your quest for purity, to not let your voting finger get contaminated, you are going to stand by and watch a quasi-fascist get elected. And I don't understand that strategy. You could still work towards justice any way you want, the same way you have when Obama was in office, when Hillary is president. But I don't think that I seriously think the rules are going to change if we have a President Donald Trump.
Well, the thing about Hillary, I don't really care that much that she's a crook, because I haven't ever come across a politician that isn't a crook.
Yeah.
I don't really, the stuff with her husband, I mean, so what? That one of the best things I think she ever did was actually stick by her husband with the whole Monica Lewinsky thing. What bothers me about Hillary is that she is a serious war hawk, and I'm really concerned that she's going to get us into World War III.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, to go back to the first thing you said, yeah, in my lifetime, I believe there hasn't been a serious presidential candidate, and by serious, I mean someone who has a genuine chance of winning, not counting Ralph Nader and folks like that, someone who really can win. There hasn't been anyone that isn't corrupt, that isn't a war hawk, that isn't bought and sold by the corporations and doesn't, you know, beholden to the rich and so on. I mean, so I agree with you. That's nothing new. The only thing new about Hillary is that she happens to be a woman. But everything else she's doing looks remarkably similar to almost every other candidate I've ever
for being with us tonight.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message. Is your data safe? Do you have the necessary information to assist you in confidently living through just about any survival situation?
to survival and gardening, off-grid living, medical knowledge, or even natural or man-made EMPs on your list of personal concerns? Do you have your documents and your personal information in a safe place in your hands where you know where it is? Well, check out our preloaded EMP-proof thumb drive. Over 3 gigs of survival documents and how-tos, plus the USDA offline food preservation website, and much, much more, including a surprise bonus we just can't tell you about here. With plenty of room left over to store your most important documents. Imagine if a megavirus or a computer failure took out your bank, or all the banks for that matter. Are your banking records safe in your hands? So when they get things fixed and repaired, you can say, hey, look, this is what I had. You have it. I want it back. Is your personal data safe? Family records, addresses, phone numbers? We'll squeeze on over to freedomslips.com. Yes, that's www.freedomslips.com. Click the banner on the homepage for the EMP-proof bullet drive to get the full scoop of everything that we offer. So, folks, keep your data safe for your peace of mind. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here. Opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, it's been another long week in Moon Rock Lake, Ohio, my hometown at the end of the empire. You might have seen that George H.W. Bush still lives, that old snake that we saw sneering in the back room on the night his son was dishonestly named President of the United States, the one who lied that he was out of the loop, the one who ordered the killing of thousands of people in Panama, the one who ordered the building of many new prisons to get tough on drugs and criminals in America, and it was all a scam, all to get elected to gain power. George H.W. Bush, the one who sneered at the funeral of Gerald Ford when he mentioned from the podium the killing of John Kennedy, the one who claimed he was not in Dallas that day, but there's a photo showing he was. The one who sits in the front row at the baseball games on national television and is applauded, not hit with tomatoes and fists and handcuffs, because he's been so successful in concealing the truth from the American people all these years. The one who has said that if the American people knew what he has done, they would string him up by a light pole. Well, actually, there were some guys right here in Moon Rock Lake, some guys who suspected the truth about George H.W. Bush, who cared enough to find out the goddamn truth about our 41st president. They were not the leading citizen. They did not write the editorials or sign the loans or even cut the hair of those who did. They inhabited the underground, the earth, the destitute, the hated, the laughed at, the so-called criminals themselves. And they understood. They knew where the power resided, where the truth could be found, what the reasons were, where the bodies were buried. They could not understand, and they wanted to find someone to ask why there might be such a stink about even talking about the killing of a rich so-called leader, and yet the real-life slaughter of thousands, millions of poor people goes by without a whisper. A passing breeze in the trees. And so, with nothing better to do, they decided to fight. KGB, they said, kill George Bush. Some graffiti found in D Block. Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you, bad boys? The men of D Block are Mark Pontiac, Bobby Ford, Stephen Baltimore, Martin Mumford, Billy Morning Dove, Miguel Mendez, and Alfred Arthur. The new guys, Michael Zags.
snatched from a downtown construction site for threatening the life of former President George H.W. Bush. The jailer is Don Burton. There's the jail. There's the outside. Some on the outside are headed to the jail. Some few realize it, and some have no idea. Unknown to the men, though felt in their hearts, is the legacy of a young mother in Panama who also suffered because a rich man in America did not care. Unknown to the men in D-Block, an underground pirate radio station had begun operating in downtown Moonrock Lake. One woman's plan to get around the arteriosclerosis blockage of non-information provided by the regular radio stations. Paul, one of Ilana's biggest fans, volunteered to let her live at his house while Paul's kids sat in front of the television eating Cheetos and drinking chocolate milk. Ilana and Paul sat on the front step. Ilana wore a hooded sweatshirt and men's tan coveralls. "I need to get back on the air," she said. She wrapped her arms around her folded legs. Paul held a warm liter of Coke between his legs. "Yeah, we need to get that stuff out of the basement. You could, well, they'd just bust you again." He ground a rock into the sidewalk with his shoe. He set his hand on the cement between them, hoping she'd take it. Ilana looked at the stubby jaw, the grizzled fingernails. She smiled at him. A wrapper car passed. "We could broadcast from your car," she said. She grabbed his hand, squeezed it in both of hers. "What do you say?" she said. Paul said it would probably be all right, except when he had doctor's appointments. "How do you do it?" he said. Ilana assured him she knew how to hook up her equipment by connecting to the existing wiring and antenna, taking out the back seat backrest and using the cushion as a desk. She would kneel on the floor. "We just drive around town. They never get a true reading on us. Oh, my God," she whooped. "And we'll be able to reach places we could never could before. The college campus, downtown drive time again. South side, north side, the mobile revolution." She hugged Paul's shoulders, making his eyes pop wide. His pop spilled onto the sidewalk. She let him go to charge into the house. He put his hand to his chest to catch his breath. At 1 a.m., the night guard clicked down the hall. His flashlight moved with his right leg. He talked into his walkie-talkie, not bothering to be quiet for the sleeping prisoners. The doors of the Sally Port clanged open. The guard stalked in, click, click, down the row, shining a light into each cell, counting to himself. "Morning, Gary," Pontiac said. "Morning," said the guard, walking past. He strode back without speaking. Pontiac sat on the top bunk, his big bare feet hanging over the side. He rolled another cigarette. Gary glanced at Mumford doing push-ups. The doors clanged shut. Gary and Pontiac repeated the scene at 2 and 3. At the 4 o'clock, Pontiac was asleep. As the night guard checked the blocks each hour and talked to the street cops who brought in prisoners and the woman who worked the front desk, while the lights in the corner clicked from green to yellow to red, and the kids drove past. The men in D Block dreamed like summer campers. They dreamed of being 20 feet to the north. What could that possibly be like? They'd never been there before. They'd each been born in jail. They'd never seen their mothers or held their children. They had always known Burton, always known his name. He'd always been there in the morning, telling them when to eat, to read, to watch television. They dreamed of really blue sky, flying up through the clouds, falling down into clouds, bouncing lightly. They dreamed of playing softball and baseball. Their dogs licked their faces as they slept. They made love to fairy princesses. They told their fathers they loved them and helped their mothers peel apples for pie. They laughed, and they smiled wide and wondered their faces did not crack and clatter to the floor like old pottery during a change in the weather. They cried as it came near the time they had to leave their loved ones, and blindly wiped real tears from their cheeks. They reached out their arms and could not reach out because of the top bunk or the ceiling. They moaned and they jerked, they sobbed some more. They grabbed themselves, not wanting to walk down the cold upstairs hall to pee. Teetering on the precipice of their dreams, they heard the school custodian whistle down the hall. They heard the jingling of a little brother's toys in the living room. They heard someone reaching for keys to start a truck. They clenched their teeth at the click of hard shoes on smooth, shiny concrete. They heard the metallic-tasting language of a machine. They opened their eyes and saw their mothers had flipped on their bedroom light against their wishes. They felt a coarse blanket on their shoulders, heard the growl of Bert. Breakfast! And the mechanical yawning at their cages. They opened their eyes, squinting, then rolled to their back and shut their eyes, trying to retrieve their dreams, remembering they were in prison. Paul sat at the light. His dashboard digital clock showed 7:39. The downtown streets were clogged with traffic. The freeway was filling with cars and trucks and delivery vans. Paul leaned his arm in his open window, picked a scab at his elbow, and smiled at the driver to his left. Alana knelt in the back seat trying to get the hang of her new office. She hollered at Paul to quit banging around. He asked where she wanted to go. She said, just drive and leave her alone. Some of their squabbling got out over the air. I'm sorry. She reached up and touched him. I'm just nervous, I guess. He smiled and turned the wrong way down a one-way and had to dive into an alley to avoid two oncoming Subarus. Martha sat in her office with the door locked and shades closed, a boombox on her desk, scanning the dials. Good morning, friend, came the weak, scratchy voice, like it was coming from Jap submarine sailors at the bottom of the Missouri. This is Alana Usak at 99.8 and moving, KROLL, broadcasting the seeds of the revolution from everywhere and anywhere. She sang something in Czech, a ditty, a swear word, an oath. Even she did not quite know what it was. Then her voice became the delicious baritone that made Paul squirm. This is Radio Free Moon Rock, my friend, coming to you live and kicking from wherever a free breath can be drawn. Here's who else? Jackson Browne. They sell us the president the same way they sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion. At the same time, they sell us our wars. Back in a few. Alana told Paul to find a parking lot. He jerked to a stop. She flopped against the car door and pulled out a cigarette, handing the pack up to Paul. How's it going? She asked. She wiped sweat from her forehead with her wrist and smiled. Better than outdoor sex, she moaned. This is the best, Polly, the best ever. My God, what a thrill. Thank you, thank you, thank you. She stretched her legs out on the back seat floor. He turned and watched the traffic on the overpass. He flicked his ash out the window, closed his eyes, and took a deep breath. He glanced back at her. Saw her hand signal as she prepared to ease back into the flow after the song. He put the car in gear and concentrated on pulling away smoothly. It's 4:50 time in America, friends, Alana began in a hum. There is hope. We have pirate radio stations in Berkeley, Seattle, Omaha, Ames, New York, Birmingham. There's a Radio Free Chiapas and a Free Radio Beijing. Keep listening. The drums of freedom beat loud in out our chests. Here's a little Lou Reed as we guide you into the 8 o'clock hour. If you haven't gotten up yet, just forget it. Stop obeying. in Panama during the invasion. Maria went back into the trailer and could not find her children. Come out, wherever you are, she sang out. She stood quiet in the hall, her hands on her hips. She knew the little one would give the others away. Soon Maria heard faint giggling. She tiptoed to follow the noise and bent over and crept into her own bedroom where she found five sets of eyes like a row of raccoons under her bed. She did not laugh or scold them. She got on her stomach, stretched out her arms, pulled them close to her. Mijos, she said. Do not be afraid. And then she led them in a rapid Hail Mary, Our Father, and Glory Be. She said the Blessed Virgin would watch over them and reminded them that their father was out with the army, making sure nothing bad happens in the night. We'll wake up tomorrow, and whatever's bad out there will be gone. We'll play soccer, have a tortilla and quesadilla picnic. That's what Conchita was saying, that we should have a picnic tomorrow. No, Mama, said Paula. She said the Americans are coming with guns to hurt us. We need to hide. You got under here. There's a room. Tried to make his little voice deep. Maria brushed the black hair from his brow, pinched her lips together. Stay here, she commanded the raccoons under the bed. She hurried down the hall, peeking quickly out the window, then moving to the door. She unhooked the latch and pushed it open a crack. She looked into the sky and saw it ablaze with exploding fireworks and arcing lights, like a farmer with a flashlight trying to find his glasses in the dark. The military jeep was back in the street, with men in the back firing their weapons into the sky. Maria looked up, and in the patched light she saw that the sky was filled with bits of dry dandelion blown by the breath of God floating ponderously toward the guns. The men in the rear of the jeep cursed the driver. The driver shoved the vehicle into reverse, rammed into a tree, pulled ahead, careened on two wheels down the street. The dandelion bits meandered down, down, as Maria gasped to see the black whale swimming above in the inky ocean with fireflies blinking around its wings and tail as the white parachutes floated down around her. Maria flinched at the sounds of their weapons tinging the sides of the trailer houses. She ducked back inside, slammed the door, rushed down the hall, then turned back to close the door again. When she reached the bedroom, the back wall was in flames. Maria flung herself to the floor, reached under the bed, began pulling out hands and arms. Stay together. Hold on to each other. Is this happening to me? She thought. Am I a grown woman under the attack of men dropping from the sky, trying to save my children by myself? I can't do this. I'm too small. She told herself to move more slowly, to make her motions controlled. When she saw the terror in each of the faces, as she hauled them from under the bed, one more set of raccoon eyes underneath, and the smoke in the room told her to send the children into the kitchen. I'm staying, said Paolo. You go ahead. I'll be all right. Papa is out there. I'm in here. You're covered. Take care of the children. You're a child too, she cried. Come, you help me with the others. Paolo accepted her hand, and they ran together down the hall that had pushed as narrow as enclosed slippery slide. Maria went to one knee in the kitchen and gathered the children in her arms as her bedroom became engulfed in the firestorm. We're going outside, she said. The bad men are out there, one said. The fire's in here. She crouched and looked them each in the eye, her back growing warm from the blades. They coughed. They dug at their eyes with toy doll fists. Juanita unlocked the door and opened it a crack to let their cat outside. Your father's out there too, assured Maria, and I will be with you. We'll keep you safe. She stood in front of them, one arm behind her, encircling the mall, one hand on the doorknob. Something popped, then exploded in the hallway. She hopped out to the metal porch and reached in and helped each of them over the gap between the first step and the trailer door. She heard the cries of her neighbors and the shouts of the men from the air. Flamethrowers were burning the trailer homes as the white parachutes continued to fall like large snowflakes. The green jeeps in the street were now filled with Americans. Music by Guns N' Roses blared in the background. Lieutenant Colonel Ryan Mahoney had not landed in the downtown area, but directly over the Fantego trailer park. Surrounding the trailers, the neighborhood was street after street of junky, dangerous barrio. As he was landing with his weapon spraying the ground below him, he was checking his map. When he hit the dirt street in front of Maria Cordova's home, he'd already decided the whole area must be secured. He ordered his men to fan out, close the perimeter, consider anything that moved to be hostile. As Maria Cordova, crouched with her arms around five small children, came moving toward Mahoney in the alternating darkness, she appeared to him like a pair of soldiers advancing. Maria shuttled the kids this way, then the other, like a mother goose, looking for a way out of the lights of a car. Mahoney snapped his M16 to his shoulder and fired in one expert motion. His bullet, made by a single mother temp worker for Alliance Systems in Hopkins, Minnesota, smashed Maria in the forehead. The force of the little missile knocked her off her feet. She floated for a long while, feet outstretched, arms swimming. She saw the stars winking, and she beamed. Nothing more to do. Everything done. Chores and duties completed. She rested at last. She landed on her back, arms stretched outward and across. Her legs curled in a figure four. The children, covered by spots of their mother's blood, scurried and fell around her. Juanita cried. Paula picked up his little sister and sang to her, De Colores. While the men with blackened faces ran all around them, the children of Maria Cordova held her dead hands and recited a frightened Hail Mary, while Paula continued to sing, Y por eso los grandes amores de muchos colores me gustan a mí. Paula cried while he sang harmony to the prayer. He licked the salt tears and tried to wipe the blood from Juanita's forehead, only smearing it. Mahoney ran forward a few steps, then leaned into the scene to make out the children. He put his hand into the air to stop the firing, but the action was automatic. His men could not see him. Only the fire of fear, fed by a wild rage to live. Mahoney crept ahead slowly in a crouch, his weapon on his hip. His tracer bullets from both sides slammed into the Cordova children huddled over their mother. A single bullet from a South Dakota teenager efficiently pierced the skulls of Paulo and Juanita. The soldier turned to his friend, his mouth open, an excited, surprised smile covering his face as if he'd just killed his first pheasant. The largest chunk of Paulo's forehead landed on his mother's chest while a spray from two boys from the same high school in Casson, Minnesota, keeping together for safety, sprayed the other three children onto their front yard of weeds and broken glass. Minnesotans ran to their kill, pointed their weapons into the air, and shot out the stars, whooping, counting coup. The retired couple in Lincoln, Nebraska now had the popcorn bowl situated between them. They brushed hands while reaching at the same time, turned to each other, and almost smiled. the Mozart NBC invasion theme music played. They tried to muffle their tune. The title Just Cause filled the screen while a United States Navy helicopter flew over the downtown of Panama City. As Dan Rather told viewers that rebel Panamanian General Antonio Noriega was on the helicopter headed for the United States Federal Prison in Miami. Likely, sources say, said Rather, to be tried for drug trafficking. In the morning, the couple from Lincoln rose early to drive downtown for breakfast. They held hands across the seat. The man stopped at the Lincoln Star Journal box outside the restaurant in FedEx quarters. As he sipped coffee, he read about the invasion. His wife read the joke of the day and birthday announcements on the morning news sheet from the radio station. That's the news from Moonrock Lake, Ohio, my hometown, at the end of the empire. And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream radio show. We thank you for joining us. We hope you'll be back next week and every week. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night to my friends, Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Don Hawksprung. Good night, Muhammad Atta. Good night, Omar Mateen. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
People's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener support.